TCU baseball is once again heating up at the right time, question mark. Meanwhile, football wraps up its spring sessions with a glorified practice in front of several fans out at Amon G. Carter Stadium. And hoops, both men and women, are still getting after it in the transfer portal. All that and more right now on this episode of Frogs Insider. Welcome into another episode of Frogs Insider. Jamie Plunkett here alongside Melissa Treewasser. We are your hosts for this wonderful podcast that you are currently listening to. Thank you so much, by the way, for doing that, for being a patron of the show. We do appreciate all of you, whether you listen on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, or you're on the YouTube channel, or you just harass us on social media and never actually listen to the show. You wouldn't be hearing this right now if that was the case. So yeah, to all of you who have clicked the link, thank you for being here in some form or fashion. We are the TCU podcast for Dave Campbell's Texas Football's Republic of Football Network. You can find this show anywhere that you get your podcasts and on YouTube at Frogs Insider. Super thankful again for all of you. Also very thankful for Hell's Half Acre Stadium Goods, our wonderful presenting sponsor for this podcast. We're going to talk a little bit more about them later. But Melissa, first and foremost, we've got other things to talk about, including spring football.
Yeah, we have a lot to talk about. There's a lot happening.
So much sports.
As this athletics year has been, there's still some really cool things happening for TCU sports this spring, including Frogapalooza and the TCU spring game, which, while the product on the field might not have gotten people too excited, it does seem like it was a cool environment and a great way to kind of end the spring practice season.
I would have loved to have been there. But, you know, when you cover baseball and you say, I'm going to be at baseball, and then baseball turns into a doubleheader that perfectly overlaps with Frogapalooza. I haven't figured out cloning technology yet. I would love at some point for that to be a reality for me. But it is not. Fortunately, Jeremy Clark was there, and he was covering for 24/7 Horned Frog Blitz. So you can read all of his write-ups over there. He does a great job covering the team, obviously. But there are some interesting takeaways, I think, from spring ball, from the spring game specifically. And I want to start here, Melissa, just with kind of the general question. What did we, if anything, learn from spring football this year?
It's a great question, and it's one that we can kind of answer in a vacuum without knowing if it's actually true until August 30th, right? But
yeah.
I think one thing that TCU fans can be semi-confident in is it appears that there is a capable backup to Josh Hoover. I think, you know, I don't think anyone's expecting Ken Seals to come in and light it up. I don't think he's the guy initially want starting 12 games, but his just veteran presence in the locker room, his ability to understand and command an offense and to execute game plans at even the most base level has to make you feel good, considering that once again, you are entering the season with a quarterback that has some injury issues or some injury history now. And so I think that we can all feel confident that if Ken Seals needs to play a half or a game or two, that the drop-off won't be precipitous. Can he go out and win games in the Big 12? I think he can. But I also don't know that you want to, you know, ideally Josh Hoover is your starting quarterback and is healthy for 12, 13, beyond that games a season. But if not, I feel confident if Ken Seals needed to take a week or two, that he can certainly lead the team and execute, you know, Brile's vision to some degree, at least at a baseline level, to not hurt the team. And I think that's a better position than TCU has been in the last several years.
Okay. Before we move on, I am going to make a comment because we have been hearing some feedback about Melissa's microphone quality, and she did in fact buy a new microphone. It's finally here. I will say in this moment, maybe crank the volume up just a little bit more.
Okay.
And also it's doing this thing where it like fades out at the end of the sentence. Maybe fiddle with it. Cause I've got some thoughts about spring football too. And I'm going to talk about them while you mess with your microphone. And we're just going to do some live podcast producing.
Okay.
As we kind of roll,
I'm just going to move this thing directly in front of my mouth.
That volume sounds fantastic.
Okay, perfect. Good. No one in my life has ever told me to be louder, by the way. That is a first. So,
well, you're welcome. It only took, what, 12 years of knowing each other for me to get to that point. It's because I'm getting old and hard of hearing is probably the thing. No, I totally agree with the quarterback take there. It's nice to know that there's some depth. It's nice to know that there are some capable players in the quarterback room behind the starter, which has been a question mark really for the last several years for TCU, going all the way back to Max Duggan's freshman year when he wasn't even the starter and Alex Delton had come in from Kansas State. And there, you know, ever since that point, it's really felt like there were questions about the first and or second string quarterback here at TCU. So it's good to know that there is some depth there that has gotten good reps in, gotten some good practice in. I'll say this as well, Melissa, and this is something that you put on the run sheet. The question about the trenches is one that I think will carry forward for this team into fall camp, because there are some good takeaways, I think, about the general level of quality along the offensive line and defensive line, even with the loss of Dom Williams. Obviously, there was an offensive lineman, Ezra Dotson Oyetode, hit the transfer portal as well. He originally transferred in from Arizona State. And there's some depth coming into along the offensive line, which we'll talk about here in a moment. But I think that there's a general the floor for both of these lines, I think, is pretty solid. I think it's a relatively good floor. It's not bottom of the basement. I wouldn't say it's the highest floor in the world, but it's an above average floor for the offensive line and the defensive line. The question will be is how can you elevate beyond that floor to be a O-line and a D-line that can impact games in a positive manner for your team? For the offensive line being, hey, can you give whoever's at quarterback enough time to make reads? Can you give the running back, whoever it is, enough gaps to break off a run? Can you block well enough that the offense can function? There were times last season where that simply was not the case, and they've got to rectify that, or we're not going to see an improvement in the offense in year two under Kendall Briles, when I think that there's enough skill position talent for there to be a big step forward, especially when you start to talk about third down efficiency, red zone efficiency, some of those numbers that maybe didn't quite hit like TCU fans wanted them to last year. If you've got competent offensive line play and you've got the skill position depth that TCU has, I think there's an opportunity to take a big step forward there. Defensively, along the line, I'm really intrigued to see how good this four-man front is with this stud position against proven offensive lines. Take Kansas State, for example. Take Utah, for example. Even Arizona, to an extent, they're bringing a ton of guys back. I'm excited to see how this defensive front stacks up against not TCU in a practice setting. And obviously, those are questions that won't go answered until we start playing actual football, meaningful snaps. But again, I think the floor is in a good spot. Now, how do you elevate from there?
Yeah, and I think you make a good point, and I think the floor is considerably higher than it was a year ago. We hope, right? Like, I think that's the biggest thing, is if there's not a massive drop-off, that this can be above competent, even if it's not elite. I think TCU can work with that, and one thing we know is Briles can scheme things up to get the ball out of whoever's playing quarterback's hands relatively quickly, and it does seem like TCU's running game is in at least as good of a shape as we could have hoped coming into spring ball. But, you know, a year ago at Big 12 Media Day, Sonny Dykes was talking about having 7 or 8 guys that were all pretty much the same. And I think we talked about this. That can be a good thing or a bad thing. Turned out to not be a great thing. I hope we're not in the same position this year, especially losing Dom Williams on the defensive line. You've got a lot of depth. You've got a lot of guys that can do good things, but I don't know that there is a standout or a star or even star potential on either side of the ball. You know, as not good as TCU's offensive line was a year ago, you still had a guy go in the third round. You still have two guys that get signed as undrafted free agents. So there was obviously talent there. I mean, that's three of your five on an NFL roster heading into camp. Is there that level of talent? I think potentially yes, but until you actually see it play out on the field, it's hard to know how it's going to develop and if it can come together in time to be good or better than good when fall camp starts.
I hear what you're saying there. And I think it's important to note as well that they went through all of spring now, as we know on today when we're recording this, Monday, April 29th, potentially two-fifths of the guys that are going to be starting in the fall, because you have Cade Bennett, the longtime commitment from San Diego State, who's going to be here this summer, probably, if things go according to plan, going to step in at one of those guard spots, potentially left guard. And then we just learned over the weekend, Alabama transfer, James Brockermeyer, brother of Tommy Brockermeyer, is going to be transferring to TCU as well from Alabama. He took pretty much all of the first team snaps at center for Alabama this spring, while the guy who is probably going to end up being the starting center there this fall dealt with some injury issues. And so incredibly valuable reps that James Brockermeyer got at Bama, now coming in to TCU. It's hard for me to see a scenario where he doesn't also compete pretty much right out of the gate for some sort of starting role along the offensive line, potentially center. If that happens, then what do you do with Colton Deary? Do you slide him back to right guard where he played last year? Do you have Ben Taylor Whitfield in the mix at guard still? Kind of what does that all look like? I don't know that we have really a great picture of what this offensive line will actually be right now, even though we've just gone through spring ball, because there are still so many unknowns about guys coming in and what the actual starting lineup's going to be.
You know, on the opposite end of the spectrum, I think one of the things that we saw a lot of good things being said about was that linebacking unit. And I'll kind of include mm-hmm. the stud position in that group as well. There's a lot of depth. There's a lot of talent. And there were still some guys that were banged up, dealt with injury. Shad Banks and Johnny Hodges did not participate much, if at all, in the spring. But there is a lot to be excited about in that position group. And the way that Andy Avalos is looking like he's going to deploy them, I think that could be the strength of TCU's defense. Is that a good or a bad thing? I don't know. But considering how bad the run defense was a year ago, I feel a lot better knowing that the linebacking unit seems really solid, really aggressive. And we have a lot of guys that look like prototypical linebackers. They've got mm-hmm. size, they've got speed, they've got some length. And so I think that that's going to be an area of strength for the TCU defense. A concern that I have that, you know, hopefully isn't a big deal come August is just there were a lot of wide receivers that dealt with a lot of injuries. Most of them seem to be minor overall, but, you would be concerned. I don't care if Savion Williams participates in spring ball at this point. The guy has been around forever. He's got plenty of game reps. He's got plenty of practice reps. But to see a lot of those guys who are, you know, only been in the system a year or have been kind of dealing with injuries consistently have to miss a lot of spring ball is a little bit of a concern. Now, are they missing valuable reps with the starting quarterback? No, because starting quarterback is missing spring ball as well. But you'd like to see just get through an offseason with health, and that has not happened yet.
And that is concerning. I agree with you there. And at the same time, I mean, the talent will bear out, I think, at wide receiver. I think that's of all of the position groups I'm least concerned about. I'm probably going to say linebacker and wide receiver right now, just because of the depth and the talent that we know is there. You mentioned Savion. You've also got JP Richardson. You've got Jack Besh, who, you know, had a mostly healthy spring and looked really good when he was healthy. You've got Dylan Wright. You've got Eric McAllister. Just the list continues on and on and on at wide receiver. And the reality is TCU dealt with some injuries at wide receiver last year too, when they, in my opinion, had less depth. Yeah. And they were fine at wide receiver last year. And
wide
I think
receiver
they will
wasn't
be.
The problem
was they weren't losing games because of the wide receiving core last year, and I don't think that'll be an issue again in 2024. When you start to talk about The lines, though, that's where maybe the questions start to crop up. But, you know, it's interesting. And Melissa, you put this in the run sheet about the quarterbacks in Mac Engel's feature, right? So he wrote this article for the Fort Worth Star Telegram last week, I suppose. Or maybe it came out. I don't know when it came out. I'll be honest.
It just came out today. I'm not 100% sure.
But. Mac, I'm sorry. I'm treating you like Craven right now. I have not read it, but I will read it. Okay. I think he listens. I think he listens occasionally. Every once in a while, I'll get a message from him. So we won't message Mac about this. Nobody that's listening, don't message Mac. We'll just see.
Everyone tag organically saying Jamie does not listen to
organically. We're going to let him discover this episode organically, and then he can respond if he feels the need. Okay. Anywho, he wrote an article at some point in time prior to the moment that I am speaking about TCU football and Sonny Dykes. You did read this article though, Melissa. So I'm going to stop rambling and sounding like a dummy and just tell me what your takeaways were from this piece.
Well, I think the most, you know, after going into his first going into the last two seasons, you know, confident in Chandler Morris and, you know, kind of playing with there's a quarterback competition, but everyone kind of feeling like Chandler was his guy. He goes into this season and calls the quarterback situation questionable. Now, I don't think he means questionable as far as talent level, but obviously his presumed starter is out with an injury. He's got a transfer quarterback who has two or four career wins, albeit at Vanderbilt in the SEC, and then a true freshman who, you know, it could be classified as a system quarterback coming out of high school. And so I think questionable is fair, but I think it's also a very different approach than what we've seen out of Sonny Dykes. I think that I don't want to say that Sonny learned some things with the hype going into 2023, but I think he definitely learned some things as far as not necessarily tempering expectations, but also not being willing to kind of let the hype machine into the locker room or into the media. He's still open and accessible and has his players open and accessible, but I don't think we hear him talking as big of a game this offseason. I think there's some humility and some understanding that this is a new age of college football. And the more you talk about how great a player is doing in the media, the more likely someone else is to come calling for them, but also the more likely they are to believe it themselves. And so it's definitely a different temperament for Dykes this year. So I think that was a fair assessment. It wasn't meant to be a negative. The other thing that he brought up that I thought was interesting, you know, there are so many differing opinions on what TCU is doing at NIL, if they're doing it successfully, how much they're spending, if they're spending enough, if they have the money to spend. I mean, we don't know. So there's a lot of conjecture and a lot of gossip, frankly, on the internet about what that looks like. But Sonny was very clear in saying that he does believe the TCUs of the world can still compete for national titles. Now, he has to say that. Like, he can't not say that. But he seemed to be pretty genuine. And one of the things that he mentioned, he made a nice comparison to the New York Yankees, always having, you know, one of the biggest payrolls in Major League Baseball and having not won a World Series since, I think, 2009 was the research that Mac did. But, yes, it's true. Like, you can't just buy a championship team in college football. And he said there still has to be team. And we have certainly seen that bear out. But it was interesting to see Sonny talk about what TCU's position is, how they intend to compete, and if he believes they still compete at the highest level. Are we ever going to see a run like what TCU did in 2022 again? I mean, I think that's the big question that a lot of college football fans that aren't in the Big Ten and the SEC are asking. And I think Sonny addressed it pretty well. So I don't want to spoil the entirety of the article. I know people have mixed feelings about Mac in the TCU community. I think he's great, and I thought this was a really, really well-written and a unique perspective that he got Sonny to talk about that we haven't necessarily seen a lot of other places. So you're getting the full, I think right now, is as good as TCU media has been in the 10, 15 years we've been doing this, because, you know, obviously Jeremy has seen every single snap that's happening at spring ball. Steven Johnson is great. I think he's an exceptional beat reporter. And I think Mac has brought some really unique perspective to things. There's still some lackeys, like present company included, hanging around TCU media. But I think we're really fortunate that we get great varied opinions and great varied coverage from all the folks doing it out there.
Hey, don't forget Mike Craven. He was out there once.
He was out there one time, and you know, it doesn't matter. You don't read his stuff, so we don't. You know, we just don't. We don't pay attention to that.
Get over to Dave Campbell's Texas Football and sign up so you can read Mike Craven. Do it right now. He's great, and he's a great writer, and I love him. And he's like waist deep, if not more so, in the magazine right now. I think he's crossed the 17,000 word threshold recently. Out of his projected 30,000 words to write.
Almost there.
So thoughts and prayers to Mike Craven. Yeah. It's tax season for that guy. Melissa, NFL draft. It happened this week.
It did.
And it was great. There was chaos. Michael Penix got picked 8th overall by the Atlanta Falcons.
I love it.
Bo Nix went 12th to the Broncos.
Insane. Love it.
Teams were reaching for 3rd and 4th round guys in the 2nd round. It was hectic as hell. I loved every second of it. But TCU had a better draft, I think, than some folks might have been anticipating based on the senior class. I had had a conversation. I went on a podcast with some New York Giants broadcasters a couple weeks prior to the draft, and they were asking questions about Brandon Coleman and Jared Wiley and Josh Newton and a couple other guys, and wondering, you know, how many of these guys were actually going to get drafted. And I, you know, it's hard to understand fully, I think, how a guy is going to translate from college to the NFL. NFL teams try to project and miss all of the time. And so, you know, you look at all of the projections for where guys are supposed to go and how they're supposed to perform. And then the NFL draft actually happens, and we learn that, hey, we still don't know anything about what's going to happen on those 3 days in 2024, those 3 days in Detroit. So Brandon Coleman, though, was the first Horned Frog off the board. He went day 2 in the 3rd round to the Commanders. I believe he was the 67th overall pick, somewhere around there. The Commanders, based on what I've read, like him as either a tackle or a guard. They like his versatility, his ability to play on either the right or the left side of the offensive line. And my understanding is that he's got a really good opportunity to see some snaps pretty early on in his career with Washington. Loved that pick. But I don't think anybody loved a TCU draft pick this year more than you loved Jared Wiley going to the Kansas City Chiefs, because now he gets to meet Taylor Swift.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, Jared and I are tangentially friends because I've interviewed him a couple of times and that counts. And I mean, listen, I love the Taylor Swift connection. I think that's great. I think that's so fun. But more importantly, I think that he is going to just about the most ideal situation that he could land in from a best chance to have a long NFL career. Travis Kelce just added 2 years to his contract, I think, today as we're recording this. But I think that Jared Wiley has a chance to really learn in that position group, to learn from one of the greatest to ever do it. And if we know one thing about Kansas City, despite the fact they are the reigning Super Bowl champions, they desperately need weapons on offense. And Andy Reid really values a guy who's willing to block downfield, but can also make plays on offensively with the ball in his hands. And I think Jared Wiley is absolutely that kind of player. So I can't imagine a much better situation for him to land in. He's not going to have a ton of pressure on him early. I think they're going to be able to develop him. I would be surprised if he doesn't see the field a little bit this year, but I think you're looking at a guy in 2 or 3 years that could potentially take the mantle from Travis Kelce as his career winds down, as he gets kind of to the sunset years of his, or when he just retires to, you know, permanently go on tour with Taylor, whatever he decides to do, I support. So I think it's an awesome situation. I'm super happy for him. And he's got, he's got a real chance to not just, you know, make this team, but to be a contributor sooner rather than later. Couldn't imagine a better system for him.
First order of business for Jared Wiley: listening to all 31 of Taylor Swift's newly released songs from earlier this month. Second order of business: just being a sponge around Travis Kelce for
and Taylor for business purposes also.
Sure. Yeah. Make that money however you need to. No, I agree with you. I love the fit in Kansas City for obvious reasons. But the reason, and I tweeted this somewhat jokingly, is we know how lackadaisical is the wrong word. Disconcertingly uncaring is the phrase that I'm going to use When it comes to Travis Kelce and protecting the football at times, because he loves to lateral randomly and then run away from Andy Reid. He loves to just haphazardly almost throw the football, even though he is no longer a quarterback and hasn't been for quite some time. Jared Wiley also was a quarterback in high school. Also and true. I just think there's a real opportunity there to keep the completely out of pocket, random ass lateral or throw across the football field alive for the Kansas City Chiefs if Travis is willing to pass that mantle down to Jared Wiley.
You are here for chaos theory is what I'm getting.
Fully on board for chaos. Yes. I would love nothing more than to see Jared Wiley throw a lateral to someone in the Super Bowl.
Okay. I'm here for it. I love it.
Like in like the unexpected pass back to Patrick Mahomes or something, and then Mahomes runs it in. Perfect. That'd be great.
I could definitely see it happen. Another great thing to see happen was Josh Newton, who is among the most beloved TCU Horned Frogs of recent memory, gets drafted by the Cincinnati Bengals in the fifth round. Another place where I think he has a legitimate shot to make that team. He might be a special teams guy early, but he can absolutely probably play in the slot would be my guess for that team. And they need some help in the defensive backfield. And just his leadership and his intangibles, I think he's going to be really, really beloved by that franchise. And they'll find a way to keep him on the 53-man roster.
I agree. He had a rough 2023. It was hard to watch. I think a lot of the secondary troubles stemmed from a defensive line that was incapable of getting pressure. And so I'll be interested to see how he fits in a defense that maybe fits his skill set a little bit better than TCU's did last season. Some other guys, UDFAs, five Horned Frogs signed undrafted free agent contracts. You had Imani Bailey also signing with the Kansas City Chiefs. They love them some TCU Horned Frogs. Miller Bradford going to New Orleans. Andrew Coker going to the Raiders, Willis Patrick going to the Chargers. The Chargers, again, scooping up another Horned Frog. And then Mark Perry going to the Miami Dolphins. Melissa, out of those five guys, who do you like the most to make the cut and the 53-man roster?
I will say this. I think both of those offensive linemen are going to be at worst practice squad guys. I think they both have a chance to stick around the program, but both of them could use a little bit of development. But I think they have the size and the tools to be there. I think my best bet to be on the 53-man roster is Imani Bailey. Again, when you look at Kansas City and how many weapons that they need and how many injury issues they had in the backfield, especially at the running back position. And when you look at Imani Bailey, who could probably be a kick returner, punt returner, profiles is a little bit similar to Isaiah Pacheco in that he's not going to necessarily wow you with pure speed, but he plays a lot faster than he is. He's a tough runner. He's a guy who's not afraid to run into people. So I think he's got a great shot. And I think Andy Reid just likes guys who are super versatile, and Imani can absolutely be that kind of guy. What do you think? Who's your number one chance to make the 53?
I'm waffling back and forth. I think that Mark Perry did so much for himself from a testing standpoint this offseason, definitely down at the Shrine Bowl. He absolutely killed it. I think if he had gotten an invite to the combine, we would have seen Mark Perry get drafted on day three. Still confused as to why he didn't get the phone call there, but I think he's got a really good shot with this Miami defense of making the roster. I say all that to say, I think it's going to be Willis Patrick. I think this is a guy who was underrated last year along the offensive line. He was probably TCU's most consistent blocker last season, both in the pass and in the run. I'm really interested to see how the Chargers, which side of the line he plays on, whether that's left or right guard, and if he has a real opportunity in camp to show what he can do. Because I think he was a guy last year who, once he got his hands on somebody, they weren't really going anywhere. I thought he did a great job at the right guard spot. The problem was that it was such an inconsistent line last year that you can only do so much as one person along that five if all five aren't in lockstep with each other. So I think Willis Patrick has a great shot. I also think Mark Perry has a great shot. I'm going to kind of hedge there.
Yeah, Mark Perry's in a really good situation too, where again, Miami lost a lot defensively and they need guys that can play. And so I do think he's got a really, really good shot. I'll be interested to see, but I would not be surprised if two or more of those guys made a roster. I think you could see 3 to 4 of them at least on a practice squad this next year, which is not a bad gig whatsoever. You know what else is not a bad gig?
Dang it. Jamie? Yeah, I was going to do it, but you got it.
I jumped
right.
in. purchasing goods and wear from Hell's Half Acre Stadium Goods. We appreciate our friends at Hell's Half Acre so much for helping us out the show and for what they do for TCU Athletics, and also just for the quality of their materials. I've got a couple shirts. I know you've got quite a few polos and hats and different things. Some of the most creative designs that we're seeing around, especially TCU baseball, they've kind of almost cornered the market, although you are rocking that incredible Ronis Cornutus.
Yeah, but this is the actual team. This isn't like, I mean.
Yeah, the stuff that Hell's Half Acre is doing, again, just unique kind of fan-inspired designs. They also have great stadium goods, flags, koozies, pretty much everything you need to make your game day experience the best experience possible.
Love them. Love Steven. Hell's Half Acre is, it's got everything that you need to be ready for game day. I say that every week. That's not like a scripted line. It's just the best way that I know to describe what he does over there at Hell's Half Acre, because it's truly the case. If you need a hat, if you need a shirt, if you want a polo, if you want a koozie, if you need some other stuff, like, he's got everything you need. Just go, except for the alcohol itself, which obviously not. Go to Flying Tea Club and buy some vodka, and then go to Hell's Half Acre and buy everything else for your tailgate. That's all you need to do. It's really that simple. HellsHalfAcreSG.com. Leave a comment saying that Frogs Insider sent you. HellsHalfAcreSG.com. Go do it now. Well, at the end of this podcast, go do it.
Yes, yeah. Stay here with us now. You know, you got
to
be patient.
What am I talking about? You're on an iPhone probably listening to this, listener. Swipe up on the thing and then go to your web browser, and you're still listening to me right now. Go in there. Type HellsHalfAcreSG.com right now. Do it. Listening to me right now.
But if you're driving and you can't quite get to the
Don't do it if you're driving. Be smart. Be sensible. But if you're sitting there at your desk pretending to work, go to HellsHalfAcreSG.com and buy something from our wonderful podcast sponsor.
You know, Jamie, you say be smart, be sensible. And there was a moment of non-sensibility, a little bit of panic last week for TCU fans. And first of all, let us welcome TCU women's basketball fans, because I don't know, there were a great handful of y'all previously. There are thousands of you all now. I think they're going to sell out their season ticket allotment. I believe it.
I'm
wishing it into existence. But
we've got we've got over 40,000+ views on the women's basketball thread on
it's unbelievable.
Horned Frog Blitz. It's absolutely incredible.
Man. Love to see it. This team made a huge splash in the transfer portal and getting a commitment from Haley Van Lith, one of the best available players, a superstar on and off the court, a brand ambassador, all of the things, and a true influencer, only to learn last week that she at some point had made a quote saying, "I have it officially signed." Now, that got spun because nobody believes that she wanted to come to TCU, I guess. And the spin zone happened, and all of a sudden it was, "I have not officially put pen to paper." And so you can imagine the sigh of relief from the tens of thousands of people that are invested now in TCU women's basketball when she posted that the pen had hit the paper late last week and informed us that she was indeed officially a Horned Frog. Something that you had been telling us was fine, that you were not worried, TCU basketball was not worried, Mark Campbell was not worried, Haley Van Lith was not worried, but she was wrapping up her 3-on-3 pre-Olympic experience and just did not wanted to break the news on her terms, which is completely, totally respectable. But she is officially in the fold. This program has done an unbelievable job. Mark Campbell has beyond hit the ground running. You want to talk about using the transfer portal? This man gets it in an extraordinary way. And Haley Van Lith is coming to play basketball, her final season of college basketball at TCU. And with it, she is bringing the type of spotlight that you cannot create in any other way. And I, for one, could not be more excited about what she's going to bring on the court and off the court to this program.
There's no question that she is the most popular student athlete at TCU.
Yeah.
And she hasn't even stepped foot on campus yet. And that's hard for people to process, I think. And people are going to say, "Oh, well, it's because of Instagram or TikTok or whatever." And first of all, yes, right? She's got over 1 million followers on Instagram. So yes, she's got over, I don't know how many, something 50K followers on Twitter, whatever. Yes. And she's wildly popular because she's a damn good basketball player. Yeah. Like she is. And we had the same conversation when it was announced that Haley Cavender was coming. Obviously, she has now reversed course and is going back to Miami to play basketball with her twin sister. But it's the same conversation where it's really hard to for a lot of people, I think, to separate the social media aspect of a person from their actual skills and talent. And so we try, and this happens subconsciously a lot too, where we just kind of reduce people to kind of a basic bit of information that we know about them. And so it's like, oh yeah, I know her from Instagram. She's an Instagram person. No, she's a hooper who has an Instagram account. And that is absolutely Haley Van Lith. I think, and I wrote about this when she was committed. I wrote about this again when she was officially signed. I think she was misused at LSU because she was asked to be a point guard, a true point guard, mm-hmm. instead of a scoring first guard, where she thrived at Louisville in that role. She averaged almost 20 points a game. She shot the lights out of the ball. And she's going to have the opportunity to do that again at TCU because she's going to be posted up next to Maddie Scherr, the Kentucky transfer, who is a true point guard. She's going to be across on the other wing from Madison Connor, who is one of the best three-point shooting players in the country. She's going to have Sedona Prince on the block, Agnes Emanopou either on the other block or in the corner, right? There's going to be so much space on that court for Haley Van Lith to take the ball and do her thing. And that is going to be a tremendous boon for TCU women's basketball to have her in that role. And I think TCU fans will find out pretty quickly that, yeah, she's got a million followers on Instagram, but this is why. This is why, is because she's so damn good at basketball. And I think that, it speaks to the culture that Mark Campbell is building pretty quickly. It speaks to, the players that he already had here last year coming in, making an impact, speaking highly of him publicly over and over, that he's been able to turn this thing around so quickly. But if there's any doubt that she's the most popular student athlete on campus or will be, her Twitter post of saying she put pen to paper, I think has over 4 million impressions already. Her Instagram post saying that she put pen to paper had 150,000 likes in the first 2 hours of the post. Like, that's unbelievable. TCU football doesn't get 100,000 impressions on a post hardly ever anymore. Yeah. Right? I think the biggest impressions that TCU football's account does is when it's showing clips of former Frogs in the NFL.
In the NFL. When they get co-tagged.
Right. I mean,
Haley just signed a brand deal with LaCroix.
And she's already got one with Adidas.
Yeah. I mean, this is, like you said, you can get famous for a lot of things and basketball be a subplot. It's the same, like, I don't want to compare her to Livy Dunn, but it's the same type of thing. Livy Dunn was not a good gymnast. Her 15 minutes would have flamed out, or she would have had to start focusing on something else, right? Like you can get famous for anything in order to stay famous and to stay marketable and to stay as a quote unquote influencer. You have to be good at something. And in basketball season, Haley Van Lith is focusing on basketball. She's still mm-hmm. doing these other things, but it's basketball that is carrying her. So she can flat out play.
Yes.
This is an incredible investment for TCU, not just from a, brand standpoint, but from a on-court product. Like you kind of detailed out with what Mark Campbell has put on this team, the way they complement each other is absolutely perfect. So assuming that they can stay relatively healthy this year, I mean, there is a chance for this to be a team that can contend for a Big 12 championship potentially. A lot mm-hmm. of things will have to break their way, but this should be a top 4 or 5 team on paper. In the Big 12, this is a team that that should accept nothing less than getting to the NCAA tournament and hopefully making a run, and they'll certainly be more than capable of doing so. Plus, you've got players that have won big games before. I mean, Haley Van Lith is kind of being exonerated for what's the word I'm looking for? She's being killed for how she performed against Caitlin Clark. Well, by the way, she was put one-on-one against Caitlin Clark after having an IV because she was sick in the morning. Eviscerated. That's what I was looking for. Mm. But this is a woman that's played at, you know, in a Elite Eight, who has played, she played a Final Four or close to it with Louisville.
Two.
She has played big basketball games. She brings championship level experience. And that is something to get super, super excited about.
She took Louisville to the Final Four. She took Louisville to another Elite Eight. She just helped carry LSU along with Angel Reese and Fluje to another Final Four. Like, the pedigree is there.
Yeah.
The pedigree is there. And sometimes even the best players have bad games. One of hers just had happened to be against Caitlin Clark, who, by the way, is a pretty damn good basketball player. Yeah. I don't know if you guys have seen the clips of her with the Indiana Fever in practices and stuff, but so she's fun. Already she's killing it already. Yeah. She's killing it. So yeah. It's great for Haley Van Lith to be a Horned Frog for a variety of reasons. The first of which is she's a great basketball player and is going to help Mark Campbell continue putting this program on the trajectory that everybody wants it to be on. Like I said, they've already added Maddie Scherr as well. They've added another commitment from a kid from USC. So they've got three in the fold. And I'll tell you this, they're not done yet. So they're going to probably be a few more commitments for TCU women's basketball here in the near future. They got a couple open roster spots.
Yeah.
And they got some folks that are pretty interested in playing alongside Haley Van Lith. So we'll talk about that when those commitments happen, because I'm not going to ruin a kid's moment. Anywho, they're not the only basketball team, though, yeah. Melissa, that is doing good things in the transfer portal. The men's team is also, in my opinion, having a pretty good offseason when it comes to the portal. When you consider all of the players that they've lost, whether it's from graduation or the portal outgoing, Micah Peavy heading to Georgetown, Jacoby Coles heading to Grand Canyon, Asan Mustafa heading to Middle Tennessee. Obviously, you've got Avery Anderson, who's graduated, Trey Tennyson graduated, Xavier Cork graduated, Emmanuel Miller graduated. You know, there's a couple other question marks there, but you get Frankie Collins, who we talked about a couple episodes ago, Noah Reynolds and Brendan Wenzel, who I don't believe we talked much about last week, even though their commitments happened prior. Two very good additions to this program. Noah Reynolds averaged 20 points a game for Green Bay last year. He started his career at Wyoming, played 2 years at Wyoming with Brendan Wenzel, who transferred from Wyoming. Reynolds averaged 20 points, I believe 4.5 assists and 3.7 rebounds for Green Bay last year, turned them from dead last in the conference, the Horizon League, to one of the better teams in the Horizon League. He won first team All Horizon League. He won newcomer of the year in that league. Was highly sought after by a lot of big programs. TCU managed to land him. Ole Miss wanted in on him. Oklahoma
finally won a transfer portal battle. It took
40 years, but they finally won a portal battle.
Did it.
They got Noah Reynolds on campus. He is signed. So is Collins. So is Wenzel. Wenzel's a 6'7 guard who shoots
some
the lights out of the ball,
outside.
Shoots 38% from three, has the ability to handle the ball, spot up shooter. You can tell by the way TCU is recruiting out of the portal what they want to be on offense next year. And that is a pick and roll team that uses their athleticism to their advantage with spot up shooters in the corner and on the wing to free up space. They want to be, by the way, a little bit more like TCU women's basketball on offense. Yes. They want to run some four out. And I don't blame them, because in this kind of era, in this kind of league, that makes a ton of sense. But you got to have the shooters to do it. TCU has been missing that piece for the last several seasons. It seems like they're starting to gather some guys who are capable of doing that. They're hosting a couple more guys for visits this week. They hosted Khalif Battle, the Arkansas transfer, last week. Had a great visit. He also visited Kansas State last week. I've been told he's planning on visiting Villanova and Gonzaga this week as well before he makes his decision, but TCU is completely in the mix there, so that's great. And then, yeah, they're hosting a couple more guys. Matt Cross is a UMass forward who is making his way to campus this week. He's 6'7", 6'8", forward, shoots high 30 percentage. I think he's 37.8% from three-point range for his career. His career started at Miami, and then he was at Louisville for a year, and then he's been at UMass for the last 2 years, so he's got one to play. He visited Wisconsin. He visited Iowa. I think Iowa is probably TCU's biggest competition for Cross at this point, but he's getting on campus this week, and he's already visited Iowa. So it feels good for TCU to at least have maybe the final say in that sales pitch to a transfer like Cross, who averaged let me pull up my stats here really quickly. I'm going to vamp a little bit.
While you're doing that, I want to say I am, after again seeing the same kind of weaknesses the last couple of years for TCU basketball, I'm really happy with the strategy that this program has kind of adopted. And it's obvious that J.B. Dixon, who I think a lot of people have complained can be a little bit stuck in his ways, seems willing to adapt and adjust to what the Big 12 is going to look like next year. So I think it's a great strategy. I think they're making really smart decisions. I love that they're adding length and size, and they're finding those kind of 3-and-D type of players so that they can still play the defense that he wants to play, but they can hit shots in the half court, which has been really an issue almost his entire tenure, with the exception of some really elite players in that area.
Yeah. I mean, Desmond Bain and Mike Miles were the two that come to mind. Yeah. Pretty dang good. So Matt Cross, I had his numbers a little bit conflated with the next guy I'm going to talk about. Matt Cross, 6'7", 230 pounds. He averaged 15.2 points and 8.4 rebounds a game for UMass last year, along with 3 assists per game. 33% career 3-point shooter, but he's got an effective field goal percentage of 58.7%, which is insanely high. Yeah. He's very good around the rim. He's great as a secondary shooter. And when you've got ball handlers like Collins and Reynolds coming in, you need a guy who can score when he catches the ball around the rim, or when he's maybe creating a little bit of space on the baseline or out at the wing, maybe at the elbow, something like that. So this is a guy who gives you a little bit of a bigger body, which TCU was needing to bolster their front court. He's a very good rebounder to pair with a guy like Ernest Uday. So this is a good potential add for TCU. The other guy that's not transferring in, but the other guy that's visiting this week is a guy from Campbell, Anthony Del Orso. Anthony Del Orso is a name that people probably don't know a ton about, but this guy absolutely balled out for Campbell this year. He averaged 19.5 points per game, along with 6 rebounds per game. He shot 38% from 3-point range this season, and that number was down from last season. So this is an absolute demon of a shooter. He's 6'6", so he's got the size to be a good wing. And I was talking to someone about him earlier today, and I think this might be maybe a reach for his ceiling, but the comp I got was, as far as transitioning up from mid-major to Power 5, was Dalton Knecht. And you think about the kid at Tennessee this year, who came from Northern Colorado and then had a dominant year for Tennessee and led them, I believe, to the Sweet 16. Again, I don't know the exact nature of that comparison. I don't know if that's too high of a ceiling to put on a guy like Del Orso, but the reality is that this dude can ball. He has shown that at Campbell for the last 2 years. He's only a sophomore this year, which means he's got multiple years to play. And he gives you a 3-point shooter who's a capable rebounder and defender as well. So it fits all of that stuff that you were just talking about, Melissa, about not sacrificing all of who Jamie Dixon wants his team to be, the kind of core ideology of his basketball program. But he also gives you more opportunity to improve offensively, which is something that TCU fans have really wanted to see for the last few years.
Yeah, it seems like it's a really smart strategy. And it's also incredibly self-aware when, you know, we can talk about how good the Big 12 has been and how much better it could potentially be a year from now. You have to raise the ceiling of your talent. You just have to. And it seems like they're taking big swings, but on guys that are proven commodities, even at smaller levels. And we've talked about this with football too. Like, is the strategy to get kind of cast-offs that were big names that maybe couldn't quite get the minutes at a bigger program, or is it smarter to go after guys who are hungry to prove themselves at a higher level? And you need a little bit of both. Like, you need those really, like, Battle's a great example of that, right? You need those really high ceiling guys, low floor, but you also need some of those guys that maybe you're taking a risk on them making a big jump, but have shown that they have talent. Because I think more so than any other sport in college athletics, basketball is the most transferable from level to level. If you can ball, you can ball. And and all of these guys have skill sets that make me believe they can be successful at that if they jump up a level to play power four basketball.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about Battle. I don't think I got too in depth into his game. He's 6'5" guard, and you look at his stats and you're like, okay, 14.3 points last year, four rebounds a game or whatever it was. That's fine. That sounds good. He didn't start a ton for Arkansas. I would just encourage people to go and look at the last 9 games of his season. He started those 9 games. He averaged 27 points a game on like 50% shooting from the floor. The dude can hoop. He scored 42 points against like Mississippi State. He scored 34 points against Kentucky in that stretch. The guy has the absolute ability to take over a basketball game. And that is something that TCU fans explicitly complained about all last season, was that there wasn't a dude. They had several guys who could get you 20, but there wasn't a dude who you knew was getting the ball in the last 5 minutes of a basketball game, and nobody could do anything about it. Mm-hmm. Khalif Battle has the ability to be that kind of guy, and TCU is in the mix with some other really good programs for his services. So keep an eye on that one. Obviously, I'll be talking about that one more over at Horned Frog Blitz as well.
There's a reason that is one of the biggest battles right now of guys running in the portal. A lot of people want to get this kid to their campus. So here's hoping, right, that we can make a final sales pitch. But Jamie, speaking of hope.
Hope.
TCU baseball.
Mm-hmm.
They gave us some hope again, didn't they?
They won
another series, won a Big 12 series, won a series they absolutely had to win. And they did it with, you know, having to play a doubleheader on Saturday. Friday night was the TCU team that we all expected to see after the first, you know, couple weeks of the season. Peyton Tolley was lights out once again. I got to give a shout out to Andrew Mosiello as well. The two of them combined just for an incredibly pitched game. And Tolley didn't have to throw 130 pitches, which was nice because he got a lot of help from his offense. TCU did the things we've been begging them to do, which is play station-to-station baseball, come up with big hits when they need them, capitalize on runners in scoring position, and put the bat on the ball. And that carried over into the first game on Saturday, and then they kind of tailed off a little bit Saturday afternoon, which was, I mean, I didn't necessarily think you needed to sweep Kansas State, but you needed to get a series win, and you needed to show some offensive hope. And I thought overall, this was a pretty well-played series for TCU. There's still some things that they need to clean up, but there was a lot to get excited about as you kind of come down this final stretch of the season to keep themselves at least in the mix to get to the Big 12 tournament and potentially make a run there.
Yeah, I liked the consistency of the plate appearances we saw, really starting with DBU in the midweek and then carrying through this weekend. They executed better. They battled much better at the plate. What were swings and misses against Texas were foul balls, getting deep into counts, working walks against Kansas State. And that's the kind of at bat that you need to string together if you want to win baseball games. Swinging and missing isn't going to get it done. And they've been doing a little too much of that recently. So it was nice to see that consistency across the board. It was nice to see guys like Jack Arthur have the weekend that they had after not getting consistent at bats all season. He comes in the fourth inning of the Friday night game because Chase Brunson leaves with an injury and has a great weekend. I think he went 5 for 11. He had a double, he had a triple, he had multiple RBIs. He played good defense out in left field. And, you know, baseball is a game of attrition. You're going to have guys go down. TCU's had plenty of that this season. Yeah. I don't think it gets talked about enough, and that's probably my fault because I'm the one out here talking about baseball. But I do think that TCU has battled some attrition really, really well this year. You know, you've got a guy like Brody Green, who's supposed to be your starting third baseman, who we haven't seen really in over a month, really, frankly, in 2 months at his full health. We haven't seen, Kyle Ayers because of his elbow injury. We haven't seen Hunter Hodges for a long stretch because of an oblique. We haven't seen Zach Morris because of an injury. We haven't seen, we haven't seen a lot of guys. And now you can add Chase Brunson to that list where we don't know what his season's going to look like from here on out because he's dealing with a back injury. But Jack Arthur stepped up this weekend, was excellent at the plate and defensively. Really good to see that from a kid who maybe didn't have the best fall, struggled a little bit to adjust coming up from Weatherford Community College. Obviously, he started his career at Texas and transferred out, but it was good to see from him just kind of putting together that weekend that he had. Also, I really loved what Sammy Myers did at the plate. Oh, really so loved great. What he did. He delivered in a huge moment on Saturday with that double. He took over in center field for Brunson when Brunson came out and played a very good center field, had a wonderful diving play with the huge bases play. Loaded to protect TCU's lead in that first game of the doubleheader on Saturday. So I loved what I saw from him. God, who else? You've already mentioned Mosiello and Tolley. They were fantastic. I thought Ben Abelt's four-inning save was incredible on Saturday afternoon. And I thought Zach Morris was really good in relief on Saturday night. You know, he comes into a game where it's 6-0 and a runner's in scoring position. Kansas State has every opportunity to fully blow the doors off of this thing. And he settles it down. And he goes 3 2/3 scoreless innings, pitches, carries you all the way through the eighth inning, doesn't let Kansas State get any larger of a lead, and lets TCU start to chip away and gives them a really good opportunity to maybe do some more damage than they ended up doing in that game. So really was impressed by Zach Morris as well. It just feels like the pieces are starting to come together a little bit more for TCU. And this is kind of how it happened last year. And the last guy that I want to shout out is Ryder Robinson, because I think his time as a freshman at TCU has been overshadowed a little bit because of Sam Myers and Chase Brunson. Mason Bixby getting some run as a freshman who throws 100 miles an hour. But Ryder has done nothing but provide consistent defense, especially since he moved to second base a couple weeks ago. And in the limited innings that he's played shortstop, I thought he's played brilliantly as well. This is a kid who gives you real like elite level defense at third, short, or second base, wherever you need him. And he's starting to put together some really good consistent at bats as well. He had a couple of really nice hits in big moments. He worked a bunch of walks this week as well. Oh, the other guy, Peyton Chatagnier. Where did he come from? He was like his opening weekend self again. It was beautiful to see. He only struck out once. He walked five times. He got five hits. The guy was great. The guy was absolutely phenomenal. He played great defense at third base again, which he's been doing. I feel like the team that we're seeing the last four games is the team that we've been expecting to see all year. And it's why I was continually banging the drum in favor of this bunch, even when things weren't going as well as they should have been, because you look at this roster and you look at them play baseball and they have such an impressive amount of talent and they are committed to each other. The vibes in the locker room never got down where maybe in past years they have. And it was really good to see. Obviously they couldn't overcome Kalen Culpepper on Saturday night to get the sweep, but I mean, that's going to be a day one draft pick. So you just tip your cap to him. You tip your cap to Tyson Neighbors, who came in and closed that game out really well for KSU. But you got 2 of 3, you have an entire week now to rest. And then you've got, a rivalry weekend down in Waco, where the Bears were a half game ahead of you for the final spot in the Big 12 tournament. Go down there and keep doing your thing and just see where the chips fall.
Well, and that's the thing, right? This team has got to prove they can consistently win games. That has been the issue for them, is that they've got to string it together. It can't be we're going to have one great weekend and then we're going to fall apart. And we've seen a lot of that. And so if they can go down and they can handle business down in Waco, which they should be able to do, even though Baylor's ahead of them in the standings, there's not a person alive that thinks that Baylor is a better baseball team than TCU. So if they can go down and they can play well, then they can all but lock up their spot in the Big 12 tournament. And again, keep that positive momentum going like they did a year ago. I think it's too much to expect they go on the same type of run, but you want to see them string together multiple Big 12 series weekends where they look like the type of team that we expected them to be. I do also want to give one more shout out though. Luke Boyers. Yeah. Boyers has been hovering around the 300 mark pretty much the entire season. He had a huge weekend offensively. He's always been a great defender for TCU in right field. But I think his leadership, I feel like we've seen him take on a more vocal leadership role. I've seen a lot more energy and enthusiasm. It seems like he's kind of taken himself out of his comfort zone to be more demonstrative and to do the things to try to get people fired up. And so I don't know if he's picked up a little bit of that from guys like Peyton Tolley in chat, because those are two very demonstrative guys. But I think Luke has recognized as might be the longest tenured Horned Frog on that team. He's certainly the guy with the most. Oh, that's right. Curtis Bird is still there. Yeah. Between Curtis and Luke are the two guys. And he's another one, too, that I think has been a little bit more enthused this down the stretch. Those are the two guys that have taken, you know, more at bats and have, you know, spent more time on the field than anybody else in that clubhouse. And I think they've recognized that they need to show these young guys how it's supposed to be. And I applaud both of them for stepping up into those roles and taking on that kind of grizzled veteran leadership, but having some fun with it too. And I think that's why the vibes in the dugout have not changed.
I agree with that. And one other person that I just want to mention, Carson Bowen. I think he's starting to realize that he is healthy.
Yeah. That's a great way of putting that.
And because he's been healthy technically all season. He had a couple offseason issues, one that he had a little bit of surgery for. I think he's starting to realize that he's healthy. Just the way that he's holding himself behind the plate, the way that he is swinging the baseball bat, he's looking more comfortable the last couple weeks, and that's really good to see as well. I will say this, though. This team does not – it's not like they are absolved of all of their concerns at this point. Because you've got the injuries that are mounting. We don't know much about about Chase Brunson. You know, we've seen Jack Arthur in left field now because they don't want Logan Maxwell out there running in the outfield. They want to protect his hamstrings a little bit. You know, there's some question marks there about injury stuff. I don't know that we're going to see Brody Green at all this year, which is just a huge bummer for him. And then you still, outside of Friday night, got some major starting pitching questions.
Yeah.
Because Louis Rodriguez and Cademan Parker didn't give you much in their starts on Saturday. We didn't see Cole Klecker this weekend either, which was interesting. But that was just due to Kansas State. According to Sarlos, that was due to Kansas State hitting much worse against left-handed pitching than right.
Which they have in crazy splits.
Yeah, they're 60 points worse against left-handed pitching, which is why you saw Braden Sloan, which is why you saw Zach Morris, which is, you know, all the lefties, just they threw all the lefties at them. Ben Hampton is fine, by the way. Little injury update there. He had a dizzy spell. He was super lightheaded. They pulled him out of the game as a precaution. He's doing well, from what I understand. So he's doing just fine. But yeah, they've got to get the rest of this weekend rotation figured out, whether that's going back to Cole Klecker, whether that's finally just biting the bullet and saying, Ben Abelt, you are a Saturday starter, because he's looked really good the last couple weeks in extended innings. Whatever that is, whether, you know, you've got to find more consistent pitching, or you can make the Big 12 tournament and it won't matter. You can make an NCAA region and it won't matter, because you've only got one guy that you trust to start the game with the baseball. And that's just not enough. That's not going to get it done. They've got, like I said, with everything else though on this team, they've got the talent, they've got the guys. Those guys need to figure it out a little bit. And so hopefully that happens this weekend against Baylor.
Yeah, we can. And there's nobody I'd rather see it happen against more than Baylor.
Oh my gosh. Piecing it all together late in the season, sweeping the Bears. Just sounds like part of the storybook ending, right?
That's how it should be. That's how it should be. You know, there are a couple programs looking for some storybook endings too. Before we move on, you threw me a meatball.
You're
over the
so
plate on
welcome.
That one. TCU Beach Volleyball, a member of Conference USA, which I don't know if everybody knows. They went out in their first year playing in that conference and just went ahead, messed around, and won the conference title.
First and last year.
Yeah, first and last year, that's right. It's a one hit wonder. So they went ahead and just won the conference title like it was no big deal, as expected. They're the number 6 seed overall in the NCAA tournament, and they will take on the 11th seed, LSU, in the opener. Waiting on the other side of that is a team who has been TCU's bugaboo this year, the Stanford Cardinals. So a tough draw for the Horned Frog ladies, but this is a really talented program. They've dealt with some injury issues this season. You know, they've got some folks, I think, getting an Olympic training. There's a lot going on, but there's absolutely nothing saying they can't make a run too. But they're going to have to get past a really good LSU team and then find a way to beat a Stanford team that has pretty much dominated them so far this season. That being said, if there's a program on this campus I would not bet against, TCU Women's Beach Volleyball is right up there in my number one or two. My other number one or two would be the program we're going to talk about next. But before we do that, do you have any thoughts on TCU women's volleyball other than they're awesome?
They're awesome.
They're awesome.
Go Beach Volleyball. Win a title. They've been so freaking close. They've been sniffing around it, kind of like equestrian and rifle, just like sniffing around it. Go get it.
Go get it. It's their turn. Another team we'd love to see win an outdoor title because they've won some indoor titles is the other team that I have more confidence in than any other TCU athletics program right now, and that is TCU men's tennis. They will be hosting a regional for the 9th consecutive year. TCU tennis. TCU tennis with the purple courts will be hosting a regional for the 9th consecutive year. They got a difficult draw, but not an unwinnable region. They will be welcoming in Arkansas, Cornell, and UC Irvine to the purple courts in Fort Worth. That happens this coming weekend. Again, this is a team that 100% can make a run to the Final Four and to a national championship. Texas and Ohio State are both really good programs that TCU has matched up with. I think they beat Texas in Fort Worth and lost to them in Austin. They lost to Ohio State the indoor championship this year, but gave them a great run for their money. They have dealt with so many injury issues, and it is a major credit to Dave Roditi, but also to his freshmen who have come in and won matches in big spots and kind of kept this program afloat as some of their top-ranked guys have struggled to stay on the court this year. And so we hope that they're healthy as they can be heading into the NCAA tournament. And that they can make a run themselves potentially to an opportunity to play for a title for TCU this spring to cap off a spring that has been difficult for TCU athletics. But you've got two teams that legitimately could win national championships or at least will be in the mix and make things fun.
At least, yeah, I'm very much looking forward to seeing the results in both of those tournament runs. And a guy that I want to shout out to to wrap everything up here, men's golf struggled in the Big 12 tournament this past week, but Gustav Fremont did not. He finished in a tie for first place.
He did not.
Won an individual Big 12 championship. I believe he finished at 9-under for the weekend. Just an incredible performance from a guy who's been consistently at the top of his golf game for the last couple of seasons here at TCU.
Much like you, Jamie, right? Consistently at the top of your golf game.
I do top a lot of golf balls. We'll just say that. Anyways, this has been the Frogs Insider Podcast. I'm Jamie Plunkett. She is Melissa Treewasser. We will be back next week after TCU and Baylor face off in baseball. Hopefully there are a couple more commitments on the basketball front to talk about as well. And we'll know more about beach volleyball, men's tennis, and maybe even Gustav Fremont at that point in time. So until then, make sure that you've liked us wherever you get your podcasts. Go like the video on YouTube as well, and we will talk to you next time. Go Frogs.
Go Frogs.